I'll give you the directions for the guided meditation, and we'll close it by making the sound of Om together. This meditation is a visualization. I invite you to visualize your interior space as being filled with deep, dark blue light. Interior space is filled with deep, dark blue light. Focus on your spine, your backbone. Imagine that all your thoughts and all your mind resides in your backbone, facing the blue light inside you. Now imagine a scrub brush, the softest, silkiest scrub brush. We are going to use the breath to scrub our spine with an in-breath, this gentle brush. We're going to scrub the spine up, which contains the mind, and scrub out our thoughts. With the out-breath, gently scrub back down the spine, blue space. With an in-breath, we'll gently scrub up the spine and scrub out all thoughts. The out-breath, we'll gently scrub back down. Follow that meditation with your breath for 3 or 4 breaths. Deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti. As we gently bring our presence back . Any comments or observation on the meditation before we begin?
Yeah, I enjoyed the visualization. It helps to focus the mind.
We continue our study. Thank you, Sam. We continue our study of Satchidananda today, the Bhagavad Gita, a path for personal, spiritual transformation. We know from our own five principles, there we go, that number 4, we become aware of our oneness with God through prayer and meditation, something we do. This is also one of the aspects of the Bhagavad Gita teaching. We notice that our first three principles, God is the only true presence and power in the universe, is an article of faith. When we experience every moment as being God being present and a power, it's no longer faith. It's experience, isn't it? We are individualized expressions of God, our divine potential and spiritual essence. We're called the Christ. We'll see in the Bhagavad Gita, this unnameable essence has another name called Atman, capital Self. We create our reality through the thoughts we hold in consciousness. Just now we practice holding certain thoughts in consciousness, whatever thoughts you were holding in consciousness during our meditation. And that is the reality that we create. And as the Bhagavad Gita is going to recommend, there is reality, according to common consensus, but it changes and fluctuates. There's another reality which doesn't change. Let's look at that. From the Bhagavad Gita, know that all this vast universe is pervaded by that which is indestructible. Indestructible, how do we get in touch with it? One of the ways is through meditation, just as we did. No one can destroy what is everlasting and imperishable. The indwelling one, or soul, Christ consciousness, is eternal, indestructible and immeasurable. The bodies, or physical bodies, of the indwelling one are impermanent. Therefore, Arjuna, whoever thinks that Atman, the self or the soul, does the killing or can be killed, misunderstands that self doesn't kill nor is it ever killed. These kind of verses, to the extent they land with us or don't land with us, are meant to be taken into meditation to explore what the underlying truths are. Let's look at Satchidananda's commentary on these verses. Who is a seer? We had a question the other day. Who is a seer? These are the truths that the seers have discovered. Who really knows the truth? The one who distinguishes between the unreal and the real. In our unity teaching, we create our unreality from the Bhagavad Gita's perspective. We create our unreality through thoughts held in consciousness. There's no judgment on this, reality, unreality, it's all wonderful. We created the thoughts held in consciousness. Can we distinguish between the reality we create, which is quote unreal, and what is real and doesn't change? This is discriminative knowledge. It's a path we may choose to take. It's a path we may adopt as an article of our faith that this is so, if we're drawn towards it, even though we don't experience it yet. That's what faith is like. I like to think of faith or belief as a ladder up to a those mesas in New Mexico. You know, in New Mexico they have these mesas that sit way high above the ground, way high, and on top there's big flat open areas, but it's all around the sides, and drops down. So beliefs or faith are like a ladder, which we are climbing, our spiritual paths, to reach that mesa. We may never reach it, we may just experience more and more of it. And even if we transcend our belief and faith and have this experience, we really don't want to do away with these ladders. Other people, they need them. Discriminative knowledge. Without discrimination, the permanent, which is never changing, is distinguished from the ever changing. So is it an article of our faith to look for that which is never changing and distinguish it from the ever changing? But the permanent and the impermanent are not completely different. Satchitananda teaches. Not completely different. When we say that something changes constantly, there must be something to change. We notice our mind changes a lot. What aspect doesn't change? What aspect doesn't change? Without that something that doesn't change, there cannot be any changes. Something permanent is there. And there are changes to it that we observe. Then what changes? The names and forms of the primordial essence, which is already there. I've never seen the primordial essence. I'm not sure exactly what that is. It's an article of faith that we open ourselves up to experience. We certainly experience the names and forms changing. The one is always there, but appears to be many. The one is always there. We may experience this in our unity teachings, just by the very name, unity. Unity. Looking at the world as unity, we don't experience differentiation between things. Yes, there are physical differentiations, but we experience some deeper unity among with our sensing eyes, hear, and so on. Yes.
So I'm trying to wrap my brain around this, but so this, what we experience right now, is considered unreal.
We could call it unreal to help us distinguish, yes.
Yeah, okay. But it's not unreal because it's the primordial essence that's constantly changing. That's what I'm getting from this. So
the names and form change.
So it's the names and forms that are unreal.
Yes.
Essence.
Not in a derogatory sense, they're just
change.
The essence.
Yeah. So we get in trouble when we think that it's when we take it, the forms that are constantly changing, we take that as real. It isn't, is it?
Impermanent and unchangeable. He's going to give an example right now to help us with this. And we're not going to be able to figure it out.
I know.
We can't figure it out. And we can put it in consciousness if we choose. Here's an example. The basic oneness is what's real. For example, let's take water and say, okay, we'll call water reality. Take water. Steam is one expression of it, and ice is another. But in water, steam and ice, you see the same essence, nothing but H2O, hydrogen and oxygen. This is an example to help us look for the experience of the one essence as things change. As human beings, generally we don't like things to change. Our bodies change, and we're not happy with that sometimes. External circumstances change. Part of the challenge of achieving the peace that we talk about is being at one with our oneness, so that as things change around us, we are at peace with it. Another technique for being at peace, things as they change. One of the teachings coming up is giving up expectations, which we don't, are reluctant to do. We like things to have patterns and turn out the same. We get upset sometimes if the normal pattern is broken and things don't turn out. So a spiritual practice is to practice continually letting go of expectations, anticipations, and assumptions. Doesn't mean we don't plan. Planning is a thing we do. And in the doing, we give up the results. A way to maintain peace and help us to experience this oneness, which we can't quite figure out.
Also, in nonviolent communications, we learn that when we get into our judgments of what's right or wrong, you know, what's good or bad, what's, you know, and labeling, in essence, that's the steam, the liquid, and the solid of the ice, of the water, which is actually just H2O in observation, just different forms of it.
You could look at judging things, this is good, that's evil, and so on, as a way our minds receive the world, and our minds change. One day this is good, the next day it's bad.
Yeah, the mind wants
bad,
to.
Next thing it's good.
The mind wants to. At least with our cultural upbringing, it seems like our mind wants to label things.
And labeling is wonderful and convenient and helpful. Sure. Helps us process through the day with ease. And yet, if we're not always willing to give it up when our experience is not what we expected, so then we keep our groundedness,
right.
So and our experience of unity.
So the idea of that principle is to let go of the thought, but feel the feelings that's going on inside of us. So we can truly let go. And be
we're grateful for our thoughts, they're useful, and they serve us. We're just not attached to them when they don't serve us.
Same can be true of our feelings, though, also. They're just another manifestation that can change, and that, can't take that as absolute either.
Right.
Yes, thoughts and feelings are part of the same family.
Yes.
Right.
They're things that reside in it. Sometimes we have one feeling about something, other day we have a different feeling about it, just like our thoughts. Are we attached to our feelings? Or can we just experience them when appropriate? Let them go. Sam, I think you need to leave now if you want to keep your commitment.
As always, I always enjoy this. It's my favorite part of the week. Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Take care, guys.
See
well.
Ya.
Okay.
So here's the example, steam and ice. Even though we see the changes and work with them, we can always remember that there's something permanent behind them all. So that's our challenge. As we experience, quote unquote, a reality, can we remember there's something permanent behind them all, which we perhaps don't see or hear or experience? Can we have faith in that? That's referred to as seeing the truth, remembering the unity, the essence, the primordial essence, the one.
Okay.
That's referred to as seeing the truth.
That's something permanent. I'm trying to remember the name of the book that I read. Ugh, it's just escaped me, it'll come. But regarding that's something permanent, is that everything is thought, everything is energy. In a sense, it's all the mind of God. So,
yes,
all of it's that's something permanent. What we're experiencing is God's awareness, God's mind. We're just thoughts. We ourselves are just thoughts.
Yes. We are so drawn to figuring these sorts of things out. We like to know. We feel more comfortable if we think that we understand something.
Right.
When our thoughts fail us, even though we work hard at it, what remains is a mystery.
Yeah.
Are we comfortable with the mystery and willing to keep our faith? And allow the mystery to unfold through grace is the challenge of faith.
Yes.
Mystery. Seeing the truth. If ever we want to do something, we should keep an eye on the reality and then do it.
Yeah.
This is a little bit philosophical. We should remember the reality. The unchanging primordial essence. And then when we do it, as different results show up, we remain in that peace of the unchanging and permanent. If we miss that reality, whatever we do on the superficial level will collapse one day.
Yeah. I meditate. Pretty much every day I try, I've been getting deeper than I've ever been before, and so it's really wild when you get really deep. This is talking about it. You know, this is putting words to what I've been experiencing.
Good.
You know, so it's
good. Words to what you're experiencing. Words are good. Any particular words that ring true with you in a particular way, it may be useful to memorize them from the Bhagavad Gita so that you can draw upon them when in your other life.
Yeah.
Things are happening,
yep.
And you feel a little off kilter. Some feelings arise. Some thoughts persist. How do you return to that original oneness that you experienced in meditation? Sometimes having memorized certain verses from the scriptures can be helpful. I recommend this because I have done that. I've memorized certain scriptures from the Bhagavad Gita and also from the Tao Te Ching. I repeat them a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As things come up in my life that bring persistent memories, which are worries, or feelings, and I use those to help head back towards my original oneness or Christ consciousness, whatever you call it. If we miss that reality, whatever we do on the superficial level will collapse one day, Satchitananda teaches. It's something like a person who goes to a lovely site to build a nice yoga ashram there, a training facility. He likes to use examples from his own experience. A lovely site to build a nice yoga ashram there, a training facility. He's decided on it. Went there, figured it out, and measured everything.
Got the architects. It's got it all under control.
All under control.
Right.
So he's established the plan, and maybe with the plan, some expectations.
Oh, yeah.
But somehow he comes to know that the plot isn't good for construction.
Oh, darn.
Uh-oh. The soil is loose and nothing can grow there. Spent all this money on these plans. Yeah. Or the soil is too full of clay and won't support a good sewage system. The location is rejected, however beautiful it is. This is our challenge. As life shows up, can we be at ease with whatever shows up, no matter what we've planned, no matter what we expect or hope for?
And then there's always the person that refuses to see if the soil is loose and nothing can grow there, or the soil is new, and they try to build it anyway.
We have Grimm's fairy tales about that, right?
Oh, yeah.
The little pigs and the wolf, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Blow your house away. Yes. Part of us knows better, and yet another part of us is so anxious to have things turn out a particular way. Shall we look at some more verses? Let's look at chapter 20 now. The following is a very well-known and repeated sloka, or verse. It is not born and does not die. Unborn, eternal, and ancient, the self is not killed when the body is killed. What is the self, Christ consciousness, the soul, something that when Atman, when you name it, rather diminishes what we might experience. And yet, since we're talkative people, we have scriptures, we name things. It is not born, mortals are born. It does not die, mortals die. Unborn, eternal, and ancient, the self is not killed when the body is killed. Here's his commentary on that. Lord Krishna is actually preparing Arjuna. We've talked about this before. How can you receive the teachings as to what to do unless your consciousness is transformed or on the path to transformation so that you can receive the teachings? These are the articles of faith that he recommends to create a reality through thought, self, and consciousness, to be open for the spiritual recommendations, what we should do. Krishna is actually preparing Arjuna. It's good to know this also because many are so afraid of death. Death. Something we anticipate with thoughts and feelings, most of us. Why? It's good to know he's preparing Arjuna because many are so afraid of death. Why? We lose sight of our immortality, or the immortal aspect of ourselves. We lose sight of that. We lose sight of our being Atman. And think constantly of becoming that. Tricky words. We lose sight of our being, Atman, and think constantly of in the future becoming that, rather than experiencing being Atman. Now, our thought is, well, maybe.
Maybe if I only do this, I'll become that. I'll feel that.
Maybe in the future, through grace, I will become that. Lord Krishna simplifies death. It's surprising to see how easily the Lord talks about it. That's why in the East, particularly, people don't seem to worry much about death. He has observed that in the Western culture there's a lot of worry about death, because we'll be dead and gone. And through the consciousness of unity, or self, Christ consciousness, Atman, that permanent, immortal aspect of ourselves, we can perhaps lighten up with regard to the thought of impending death. Lighten up. And he asserts that in the East, with their spiritual traditions, there's been less of a heaviness or worry about death. More verses?
Sure.
Yeah. Then we'll close at 5:2. Oh,
we go there.
Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2. Now we'll look at the next two verses, 21 and 22. Whoever knows the self, indestructible, eternal, birthless and changeless, in what way would such a person kill Arjuna? Who would be killed? Who would be killed?
I don't think unreal would be killed. unreal would be killed.
I don't think he's recommending killing or murder or war.
Saying, in a sense, that's what would be killed. But it's just, you know, if you go back to what he was saying, it's the unreal that would be killed.
Sometimes I like to use the analogy of a man on Mars looking down at the Earth. Mm-hmm. Ah, there they are on Earth. Isn't that interesting? All those moving things and growing things coming out of the ground, green things, and things moving around. Oh, that's interesting. That thing did something to another thing, and now one of the things is no longer moving about anymore. That's interesting. Things seem to come and go. Isn't that interesting? Looking at life.
But it's like you said, you don't think he's recommending killing, but This is what really gets, it's so hard. Like you said, you can't wrap your brain around it, but
we can open ourselves to experience the truths here. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Gita recommends that we do what is ours to do. Reverend Rush talked about this today, spirit-driven. And the Gita points out that if you were born a warrior and meant to lead your people, and you're led to a righteous war, one of your duties is to wage war, which involves killing people. Right. However, can you do it, amazingly enough, with disinterest? as your duty.
Have you ever seen the movie The Last Samurai?
I think so.
I thought that that was a surprisingly terrific movie.
Yes.
And it shows, I think, exactly what you're talking about, because it's the one with Tom Cruise is this American mm-hmm. Western drunk
yes.
who ends up in this, you know, Japanese, I think it's Japanese culture. And, yeah, the Japanese were the samurai, right?
Yes, in ancient Japanese tradition, the samurai were soldiers
right.
who pledged fealty to a daimyo, which was their general or leader, a warlord.
I just remember one of the final scenes in that where, and the samurai, Tom Cruise ends up being immersed in this culture.
Yes.
And he becomes a samurai eventually. And one of the final scenes is where his mentor is getting slain in a battle. But it's one of these righteous battles.
Metaphorical battles.
Yes, of course. And as he's dying, he's seeing this beautiful flower, you know, on a stem. And he's watching the flower. Wow, isn't that beautiful? You know, as he's dying, as he's being killed, slain, he sees this flower and how beautiful it is. And you realize, you know, just how his, you know, it was like, it was his to do.
Yes.
But he was not doing it. He was doing it in that detached way, manner, that he was still able to enjoy the beauty of the flower as he was going down.
In the moment.
Mm-hmm.
He remained in the moment while he was capable of being in the moment. Why can't we exhibit the face of God right now? And in the moment of our death, continue to experience the face of God, being the face of God. Through our studies and through meditation, as we open ourselves up to these, we train ourselves and steel ourselves to remain in that centric peace, no matter what, even as we're experiencing our demise. The Last Samurai, great.
I never thought I'd be recommending a Tom Cruise movie, but Mateo is terrific. One of the best I've seen.
There's another samurai story that you have heard me tell. The samurai were sworn to follow the instructions of their daimyo, the Lord. That was their life. It's sort of like the Marines and Semper Fi, Semper Fidelis. Doing your duty rises above all other things, and doing it with a sense of devotion and fealty. The samurai entered the hut with instructions to kill the enemy who was there, kneeling. He went into the hut, raised his great samurai sword over the man, and was about to swoop his head off. And the man looked up and spit in his face.
Mm-hmm.
The samurai became enraged, and he put his sword down.
I think I heard. Yeah. In that moment, he became enlightened.
He put his sword down because his emotions overtook him, and he could no longer perform his duty as an act of service to his Lord. And do things as spirit guided him, rather his ego mind and feelings took over. He got enraged and he told the man, I will not kill you because I lost my center. I lost my center. And we know that our own soldiers in war, when they kill others and are not centered, will sometimes come home with PTSD. Deal with what they did because they didn't perform it with a proper consciousness.
Yeah. I guess I'm confusing it with another story, and maybe I heard this from you, I don't remember.
I've repeated it before.
Well, this is slightly different. It was about an army. They were about to overtake a town, and they were just destroying all these towns, and there was this one teacher who just wouldn't leave, you know, and he absolutely had no fear. He just had no fear, and he knew he'd be mowed down, and he just stayed there. And what it was as the army came in and the guy was ready, so this is where it ties in with what you were saying, sort of. You know, he was ready to slay this man. And he said, "Don't you realize, you know, I'm going to, you know, destroy you, cut your head off, whatever." And the guy was sitting there looking at him, and he said, "And I will look at you absolutely unblinkingly as you cut my head off." You know, he had no fear, none whatsoever. And as soon as that was the soldiers, he couldn't kill him. I mean, he realized that this guy was stronger than he was.
Yes.
But the man sitting there had no fear, none whatsoever. He would sit there unblinkingly as his head was cut off. And the soldier realized how much stronger that man was than the soldier.
Yes, it's an example of how the soldier wasn't acting from his sense of
right.
duty or consciousness.
Right.
If he had been, he'd say, "Well, great, you know,
right.
chop the head off,
right.
on to the next one." So when he realized his lack of centeredness, he knew that he would not act from his center, but from some other place.
He was in the presence of a much stronger soul.
Someone who set an example for him.
Yeah.
It's 2:05.
Okay.
We'll just do the next sloka, and then we'll close. Just like casting off worn-out clothing and putting on new ones, that which is embodied casts off worn-out bodies and enters others that are new.
Reincarnation.
In our Christian tradition, we have various examples of people physically surviving their bodies. When Christ comes, all the dead will rise out of the tombs. In the Indian tradition, they have the idea that the soul will go from one body to another, reincarnation. The underlying aspect is there's something, not physical, that persists. So rather, if it's reincarnation or bodies rising, key principle is there's something that persists, and if you experience it showing up in another body, which they have taken as their article of faith, that works. It's not essential to pull that. The essential idea is the bodies, when they become worn out, that which is embodied, that immortal part, casts off the worn out body. Casts it off. And then where the immortal, permanent, changeless thing goes, is another question. Could enter other bodies that are new.
Interesting.
That ends our session for today.
Thank you.
Shall we close with an om?
Sure.
Close with an om. Let's focus on our breath. We may choose to focus on that great, dark, deep blue space inside of us, scrub those thoughts up and down our spine of that brush with a few breaths. And the deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti.